Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
A commercial astronaut back from Earth. What's next? You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. John Schaffner flew to the International Space Station back in May, spending around 10 days in space. Now that he's back on Earth, he's working to inspire the next generation of astronauts to follow in his path. We'll speak with Schaffner about his efforts to bring space to the classroom. Then, black holes. They're destructive, they're mysterious. But could they have a sibling? We'll dive into the theoretical existence of white holes. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? John Schaffner is back on the planet after his 10-day mission to the space station and back. He's now embarking on a new mission, one to inspire young people to follow their dreams of living and working in space. We spoke with Schaffner as he prepared for his flight and from orbit, and now we're speaking with him while he's back on the planet. John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Brendan. It's really nice to be back with you and talk to you from Earth again.
I was going to say this is a very terrestrial interview this time around. With that said, what's it like? How is it back on the planet?
Well, it's really strange, you know, to hear people say "Welcome back to Earth." You know, I heard that endlessly when I got back. I was not prepared for that kind of thing. I go, wow, that is a funny thing to hear. But it made me think, you know, Brendan. You know, to continue with that is that, you know, I'm thinking in 50 years or whatever, 100 years when traveling, you know, around the solar system or different places will be more common for people leaving the planet. That will be a very common thing to say. When you say, someone says, welcome home today, or welcome back to, I live in Knoxville, welcome back to Knoxville, people will say, welcome back to Earth.
And let's talk about that a bit, John, because the last time I spoke with you, you were in orbit. We talked about your ride up there. What was the ride like back? What was that welcoming back to Earth like? I've got to imagine the atmosphere was a little unwelcoming as you were punching through it. Tell us a bit about that trip back.
Yeah, well, reentry, you know, in the Dragon, you know, leaving the station, of course, is sad. You know, when your time is up and you leave. I loved it there, you know, so very much. It's a marvelous machine. The ISS and the crew treated us so very well, and we had a lot of good activities. And then you comes to actually the activity starts the day before departure. You start the pack up and organizing all your science, get it back in the freezers and the materials gathered, and then planning departure conferences, you know, on the briefing for the departure schedule. And then departure day, you suit up and you float back into the Dragon. And it's kind of like being back in one of the many simulations we did at SpaceX, and it's just normal ops. So, yeah, you know, that leaving part's sad, but I tell you, we got some marvelous, marvelous pictures. We departed from the Zenith port in Node 2, and as we go up, leave vertically to leave the station, we got this marvelous view of the station receding under us. But then when we got up behind the station, you actually do what's called a retrograde departure, where you accelerate up, and that takes you to a higher orbit. And at a higher orbit, you actually go slower, you know, in actual surface speed relating to the Earth. So you fall behind the station. And then we eventually do another small burn. It drops us down below and under, and then we go away. But during that back up and behind, as we're coming back to begin going down below, the view of the station, Brendan, was right in front of us. We were not expecting this. This gem of a machine just sit there glistening in the sunlight in the Earth scooting under both of us. We got this nice view for 45 minutes of the International Space Station right there in front of us as we floated around behind it. It's marvelous. Spellbinding. Then, of course, we're back in the seats ready for the re-entry burn a couple hours later, and then you come in. And then you come into the re-entry sequence.
That's got to be an incredible sight, that so few humans have seen. Even some astronauts don't get a sight like the International Space Station like that. That's incredible to even fathom that that you had a chance to see that. That's so cool.
Yeah, and you catch it. You know, you got to catch it at the right time, so you're in sunlight. You know, we could have easily done that in darkness and missed the entire show. But I'm very, very, very happy for that.
We talked when you were on station about some of the goals that you have now that you're back here on Earth, and we're going to talk about that in just a little bit with a new program that you're launching. But I want to talk a little bit more about your time on station, and I'm only going to mention this because you bring it up in this new program. It's about life on the space station. You had the opportunity to use two different types of space toilets, right? One on the ISS and one on the Dragon. What was that like? What was life like using the facilities in space?
Well, you know, in Dragon, it's a you know, meant to be a, if you really need it kind of a deal. You know, it's a fundamental thing. It works very well. You know, actually, it performs perfectly its function, and you're in microgravity, so you don't really care if you're on the ceiling or on the wall. Close quarters, so you have to be comfortable with your crewmates. You know, we have a nice screen that we pop up during those moments, but it's easy, and everyone was happy and comfortable doing that. Station, completely different, of course. It's more like a public use toilet. It's there, you know, in node 3, around the corner. People are coming and going a lot. You know, some of the most difficult moments are when you've been delayed on an experiment and suddenly you need to go, you've been holding off, and you go flying down in there, you know, into node 1, turn the corner, and the door's closed. Somebody's in there. So so you learn really quickly that if you think you need to go, it's time to go. So, but the toilet, the WHC on the ISS, performed perfectly for us. Everyone was well trained. We spent a lot of time training, and it's one of the things I think astronauts fear the most, is because you don't want to break the toilet on the ISS.
It's truly mission critical hardware, right? I mean, it wouldn't be fun if that wasn't there.
Oh no, it would be. Yeah, would not be a good day. Sure.
Well, that's a good segue to the program that you're launching, Habitat Space. This is launching in fall of 2023. John, tell me a bit about the kind of overall goal of this program and what you hope to accomplish with it.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. You know, it was one of the main pillars of my mission was, you know, not just to take, you know, the young John to space. You know, when I was a 10-year-old, I fell in love with space. So it was always in my future somewhere, and it finally arrived, you know, kind of took a while. But I wanted to also have a chance to remember that there are other 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds out there today that would be wondering about what space is like. And in my case, while I was in school, the school system was not geared to recognize the exotic nature of my dreams. You know, space at that time was very new. But I love space and science. So in the area where I grew up, in Appalachia, we want now to, and I think it's important, to support schools and help the schools develop a curriculum base and a learning structure that helps young students voice what is in them that they love. Because I think really what's in you when you're 10 and 12 is going to stay with you your entire life. And if you're successful and lucky enough to be able to do that, then you've done your dream for your entire life. So the Habitat Space was a series of 16 videos that I put together on my time on orbit with the help of Commander Peggy Whitson. She was sometimes my cameraman and sometimes my the subject of interest in the videos. So we filmed things that just depict normal life in space for the 10 and 12 and 13-year-olds to say, okay, I imagine, I think I know what space is like, but what's it really like when we live in space? So we showed some daily activities of what's it like to live on the ISS. You know, just daily stuff, like at home.
You mentioned that when you were growing up, there were no kind of no way to recognize these exotic dreams that you have. But as you mentioned, going to space is not going to be an exotic dream in the future, right? I mean, this is kind of practical training for these students, is it not?
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And that's the other main thing here, is that space is now here to stay in a big, big way. It's always been here, but now it's so visible and so real. You can actually today order up a space flight. design it, order it up, and go. You know, it still takes a while to organize, but there are agencies, groups, and companies out there that will put that together for you. And as the future comes, the 10-year-olds today are going to be the Martian astronauts. They're just beginning to realize that. So, you know, to get students and primarily also teachers to understand that these dreams are real. And for students that have aspirations and love of science or space, let's show them that how real it really is and let them start really tagging on to it and identifying how their normal daily life today still exists. It happens a little differently, but we do things in space that we have to do on Earth in the same way. So that contrast is what I wanted to create with students.
And I asked you about the toilet earlier, John, because I know a lot of kids ask astronauts that question, but it really does speak to that point you make where you're trying to make that connection. Like, everybody goes to the bathroom here on Earth. They have to go to the bathroom in space, right? What other parts of living in space did you kind of highlight with this program to kind of show that there are these parallels between living and working on Earth and living and working in space?
Well, you know, a big one we get asked a lot is, what do you eat in space? So we showed the very nature of selecting food and how food is maintained, how we eat food, our clothes, what we wear in space. You know, you don't really think about, okay, you're in space on a space station. What are you wearing every day? Well, we float around in shorts and t-shirts. You know, it's like life here in your home or in your office. It's just lacks gravity. So, and kids don't think about that exactly. They think they have these imaginings of space, but I want to tie that to their normal lives so they can realize and recognize that, yeah, I can do that too. I go there and I can do that. And here is a direct correlation to how I live my life here. And the push for that is so the teachers and the students together can realize that this is an attainable goal for children today, for students. I can dream and execute and move toward a life that either is in support of humanity going to space or going to space myself or science and research related to that. It's all the things combined. It's living in space. So Habitat Space was designed for that.
What barriers are there still, John? What do we need to overcome as a species or as a community to make this a greater reality in the future? Space is still limited to a very few amount of people. That is growing. But what is still out there that's preventing more people from getting into space, from getting these kids off of this planet and following these exotic dreams, as you say?
You know, the obvious is total cost. It's still expensive to get mass to orbit. A lot of that is being worked on by a handful of companies that are working on how do you scale up to commoditize the lifting of a kilogram to orbit. What does it take? What does it take to live there? You know, one of the big factors is, of course, water. How do we sustain ourselves? And water is heavy, and it takes a lot of taking heavy things to space is expensive. And we actually cover that in one of our videos in water recovery, showing how we conserve some of the critical elements, you know, for living in space. Other things are, you know, the things that go along with space is understanding what resources are important, true, but more what is the return in order to get more people involved in space. So far, it's been government agencies doing this, but the push now is to develop platforms so that commercial entities can go there and achieve more and do things in a way that where microgravity provides some feature of response, either an experiment or a product or a design, that microgravity enables something differently than here on Earth. And we can develop commerce in space, whether it's drug discovery, pharmaceuticals, metallurgy, developing things where proteins and metal crystals form differently, higher strength in orbit. And once we start sending people to space routinely for commerce and we get a return on investment, then you get a flow of people and resources. And pretty soon, true tourism would follow.
Finally, John, a question and then a follow-up. One, any plans to go back to orbit? And two, do you need someone to hold the camera for you? Because I'm really good at holding microphones. I can probably hold a camera for you if you needed the help.
Yeah, well, actually, I started planning my return the moment I got back. No firm plans yet, but I'm going to go. You know, for now, I'm having a lot of fun. The Perseid Foundation was designed, which was the initiator here, to carry these videos forward, engage with schools, primarily in my first local area here, and help the teachers recognize how to get the students excited. So my first love now is helping teachers get the kids' eyes wide open and answer those questions about the toilet and the food. So I'm going to work on that for a while with the Perseid Foundation. We're launching tonight the series of videos with a group of educators and other like-minded folks to take these and spread them out. And they are tools designed for teachers to use in classrooms as primarily conversation starters to get the kids' attention and to get them excited. And we'll see where it goes.
We've been speaking with John Schaffner. He was the pilot for the Axiom 2 mission. His program, Habitat Space, launches this fall. John, always great to catch up with you.
Thank you, Brandon. Always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Still to come, could there be more than just black holes out there? We get theoretical about a black hole's possible sibling. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Black holes, they're destructive, they're mysterious, and could they have a sibling? Here to talk about the possibility of white holes is Paul Sutter, a research professor in cosmology at Stony Brook University. Paul, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So, Paul, we have covered black holes quite a bit on this show, but not white holes. Tell me a bit, what are these fascinating siblings of black holes?
Yes, white holes are the mirror images of a black hole. So the basic black hole construction is that you have a singularity at the center, which is a point of infinite density. Surrounding that is a shell called the event horizon. And this is the boundary of the black hole. Once you cross the event horizon, it is impossible to escape. You can never leave. The only way to get back out of the event horizon is by traveling faster than the speed of light, which is kind of a no-no in our universe. And so you can't. A white hole is the mirror image of that. There is still a singularity at the center, and there is still an event horizon, but it operates in the exact opposite way. So that if you are inside of a white hole, if you are already finding yourself on the inside of that event horizon, you will be ejected from the white hole at a speed greater than the speed of light. Space-time itself will flow out of the white hole and take you with it. And if you happen to be on the outside of a white hole, it is impossible to cross the event horizon. You can't get inside of it.
That is fascinating and also a bit terrifying at the same time. Paul, how do we know that these may exist? And just bear in mind the extent of my theoretical physics knowledge as I saw Oppenheimer a few weeks ago. So please help us understand how we know that these things exist.
Well, it turns out, unlike their cousins, the black holes, the white holes do not exist, at least as far as we can tell, which is a very interesting case because the mathematics of general relativity, this is Einstein's relativity, this is our modern conception of gravity, this is how we understand how gravity works through the bending and warping of space-time itself. This theory, that this machinery that we have for describing gravity, predicts the existence of both black holes and white holes. Both are perfectly allowed by the physics of general relativity alone. And yet we only see evidence for black holes in the universe. We have no observations for any white holes. We do not see any white holes. And we strongly suspect that they simply can't exist.
In cosmology, is that kind of the binary or the opposites really what help you understand things? As you mentioned, like I'm thinking of like matter and antimatter, white holes, black holes, like understanding these opposites is what's helping you understand what you're actually observing, right?
Yeah, in physics, we encounter what we call symmetries in nature all the time. So, and symmetries are everywhere in our theories of physics, and symmetries are a part of our modern understanding of physics. And so the equations that we write down, the mathematics that we use to describe the universe are full of symmetries, and these symmetries are very powerful. And looking for where the symmetries work and looking for where the symmetries don't work both lead us to greater understanding of our fundamental theories. In the case of white holes versus black holes, the symmetry that we see in the equations of general relativity is what's called a time reversal symmetry. It turns out that the math of gravity doesn't care so much about time. Objects can flow from past to future and from future to past just as easily, just as equally in bare general relativity. The white hole is actually the time-reversed mirror image of a black hole. It's the formation and evolution of a black hole just run backwards in time. And general relativity, because it is time-symmetric, because it doesn't care about the flow of time, we get both solutions. But other fields of physics, other areas of physics do care about the flow of time. They do care about past versus future and future versus past. And that is where white holes get into trouble.
And how so? How are they getting into trouble?
So the pure time reverse of a black hole is like playing the movie of the formation of a black hole in reverse. And in order to form a black hole, you take a giant star and you let it die, and its core collapses and reaches incredible pressures and densities to the point that it just collapses down into infinity and out pops a black hole. You can run this process in reverse using the mathematics of general relativity. And in that case, you have a white hole that is emitting particles, and then the white hole explodes and turns into a star. General relativity allows us to make statements like that, but other fields of physics do not. You can't just explode a star into being. This is a violation of our understanding of thermodynamics, of entropy, of how order and disorder relate to each other. And so the fundamental physical process that leads to the formation of a black hole can't just be run in reverse to give you the formation of a white hole.
Would there ever be a scenario where that is possible? Could the laws of physics change, or our understanding of the laws of physics change, that things could happen like that?
Oh, of course. Our understanding of physics constantly changes, which is why there are still physicists, because we're always trying to change our understanding of physics. And we always update things, and we always gain new knowledge. It is perfectly possible that someday we will have a more sophisticated, a more advanced understanding of physics, and that more sophisticated understanding of physics will teach us about how white holes can actually exist. But while that's a possibility, it's a very tiny possibility. The physics that we understand that prevent the formation of white holes, our understanding of entropy and thermodynamics, are incredibly well tested, incredibly well understood. And so to violate that is no small thing. It's not impossible. I will always leave out the possibility, but I'm not exactly going to hold my breath.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is good news, because a white hole does sound quite terrifying. So I'm glad that we may not encounter them, or very likely will not encounter them. But Paul, you know, you study cosmology, and we know that there have been some really incredible findings when it's come to black holes recently, with imaging of black holes, also with gravitational wave observations. In the last few minutes that we have with you, can you kind of tell us just how our understanding of these black holes is kind of changing rapidly in these past few years from a cosmologist's perspective.
Oh, yes. And what we are beginning to understand at a very deep level is just how connected black holes are to their host galaxies and to the wider universe. This is especially the case for what we call supermassive black holes, which, as you might guess, are black holes that are very, very large. We're talking millions or even billions of times more massive than the sun. It seems that every galaxy has a giant black hole in its heart. Even the Milky Way has a giant black hole in its center. But these black holes have an incredible influence on their host galaxy. Matter can flow into the black holes. It can be ejected from the vicinity of the black holes. This can heat up the galaxy. This can drive out gas. This can regulate the formation of stars. Black holes are a very, very important part of galactic evolution. In fact, if it weren't for our supermassive black hole in the center of the Milky Way, very likely we wouldn't be here because the Milky Way would have formed too many stars too quickly, and there'd be nothing left by the present day in the present age of the universe. And what we are learning, to our delight and our surprise, is that galaxies are forming very, very early in the universe. We're talking just within a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. And going along with those galaxies are giant black holes. And we're learning a lot about this with the latest observations from the James Webb Space Telescope, which was designed to study exactly this. And this is actually a current problem that we are trying to understand, is how do galaxies and black holes build themselves up so quickly in the early universe? This is actually a very exciting problem that we're trying to solve right now.
And what questions, aside from that, do you still have that need to be answered, that could be answered over the next few years as JWST continues to bring us back incredible observations and other sensors are getting far more sophisticated, that we're really starting to understand these much better? What other questions do you have, Paul, that you need answered?
Oh, I have lots of questions. I have more than enough questions to last a lifetime, which is a very good place to be as a scientist, because it's a joy to try to uncover these mysteries. And every time you get an answer, you get a dozen more questions and you add it to the list. And that's fun. So I enjoy learning about black holes, studying black holes, and the role that black holes play in cosmology, in the evolution of galaxies, the role they may have played in the extremely early universe, even in the earliest moments of the Big Bang, that may have fashioned some black holes that still persist to the present day. And so just trying to understand the greater role that black holes play, that these are more than just engines of destruction. They don't just sit there and gravitate and things fall in and they vanish from our universe. They play an active and dynamic role in the evolution of our entire universe, and teasing that out identifying the story that they play in our wider universe is very fun for me.
And you're making them a lot less scary for me. So thank you, Paul. Paul Sutter is a research professor in cosmology at Stony Brook University. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org. Are We There Yet is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.